Welcome to ICBC, where we are going to be talking about Return to Joy section of sexual addiction. As you know, ICBC stands for Icy Cold Bitter Chill. And we're all glad to be here in Iowa, I'm sure, to enjoy some of that. We're talking again about the characteristic of addiction, that it involves a catastrophic failure to reach adult maturity, and that's what leads to addictions. Now, let me start with a comment that was left off from the last session, and a few of the here were the last session, so you can add this to your notes, and the people who are just tuning in for the first time will wonder what on earth this is about. But there's an interesting characteristic of maturity, which is what we were talking about last time, and that is that your brain allows you to understand one level of maturity above the one that you're at. So let's say if you are at child level maturity, adult maturity makes sense to you. It's a little hard to do, you can't really pull it off with joy, but you can understand it. You can figure out how that would work, and your mind can simulate what that would be like. But you get to parent maturity, it makes no sense to you at all. You'll end up coming up with wrong answers to why and how all the motivation works for you at parent maturity. You can maybe understand the requirements, but if you try to think of how it would actually work, your brain won't do it for you. So one of the things that you will find if you're trying to explain maturity to people is that if you're trying to explain a maturity level that's two levels above the one they're currently at, they can memorize a list, kind of like a parrot can repeat things back to you, but they will not be able to actually understand how the whole thing works. And so that's one of the reasons why parents love to say to their children and infants, you'll understand this when you grow older. In fact, it's been part of culture. Everyone knows there's something about this that we can't explain now. No one has known exactly why. But when you get to one level of maturity below, you understand what it was that they were trying to explain to you. And there's a lot of things that way. I thought I'd throw that in to help some of you that might have thought one of two things. Either how am I going to explain this to people when I get back, or why doesn't that make sense to me when you were listening to it? It works both ways. Hey, you know what? We got to get over the idea that it's bad for us to admit that we lack maturity, because we'll never take the next step. Maturity does not give you the slightest bit more value. Scripture makes that abundantly clear. Being more mature is not more valuable. Being more mature is an important way to go. But like we pointed out before, we never are as clear about the value that a human being has than when they're a brand newborn baby, right? The least maturity almost that they could have. And that's the time when they're the most clear about their absolute unquestionable value. So we've got to separate that as we're talking about. It is okay to not be mature and to have holes in your maturity. You did the checklist last time, you all found holes in it. You know, I think there's only one who wouldn't have holes in their maturity, and he didn't come to the conference in a visible form. Okay, I am Dr. Jim Wilder. I'm from Pasadena. If you were here yesterday, I'm the same guy. This is a place that I've worked, Shepherd's House, and it is a pastoral care center, and we are working on developing this life model, which is a model that we hope will address all of the aspects of life. And the reason we're excited about it is that we hope to help the body of Christ to work together and not be so fragmented in the kind of care that we give for each other, so that we can sort of have a common language in some way. What we're going to talk about today, though, is the subject of joy and how to get back to it. We'll start out with the first talk being about what joy is itself, so that you understand what we're getting back to when we get to the second part of it, which is returning to joy. Joy is the evidence of a well-synchronized brain. If you look at what it is to be human from a biological point of view, a neurological point of view, the brain doctors will tell you that we are creatures of joy, that it is our natural state. It's the process that creates our identity in terms of our development. We grow our identity and our center for identity based on joy. It's also the basis for bonding. So you want to know, how do you form bonds? How do you form bonds in your church? How do you form bonds in your work, in your family, in a blended family? Joy is the basis for bonding. And joy is what gives us our strength. The strength of your nervous system, how much you can handle, is directly related to the joy level that you receive. Now, joy, as far as your brain is concerned, means relationship. Someone is glad to be with me. I'm glad to be with them. We are glad to be together. It's a completely relational concept. Then we're talking about a nervous system. Also, as far as the nervous system is concerned, we are creatures of quiet. Quiet together is our natural state. And quieting creates our identity. The people who help us quiet and rest are the people we love to be around. And quiet is also the basis for bonding. We bond to the people who quiet us and help us quiet. And quietness gives us our strength. The way to look at it is the more that you can quiet, the more you can handle. So if it gets to be an uproar, you can still quiet it. You're doing well. Quiet together means that we are not alone, that we can rest, that we can still and quiet ourselves, and that I am undisturbed even in the presence of my enemies, for someone is with me. It's one thing to be alone and quiet. If you've ever been someplace and you felt you were totally alone in the quiet, it's not restful. Quiet together is we are able to quiet ourselves and be completely at rest because we're not alone. And there's someone with us who's looking out for us, who's part of what's going on. And so that's why there's a loneliness that never brings quiet, because it's an isolation, and there's a quiet together that brings the kind of rest that we were meant for. And so whoever designed our nervous system designed for us to rest together. We are also creatures of rhythm. And rhythmic change is our natural state. We alternate between joy and quiet together. That's what your nervous system wants to do. If it is alternating in a rhythmic way between joy and quiet together and joy and quiet together, there's nothing more that you can hope for in the day. This is bliss. This is what our nervous system is absolutely most happy about of everything. We just have joy and quiet, joy and quiet, joy and quiet. We never get too tired because we always have the quiet, and we never get too bored because we have joy coming. And if your anticipation is that I'm going to have joy and quiet, well, there isn't a person in us who would want to turn away from that. One might hope that there might be a place of eternal joy and quiet that we could spend our time in eventually. You know, that's our things. Now, synchronized rhythms create our bonds. What does that mean? It means that if people share our joy with us and share our quiet with us, so we can quiet together and be joyful together, then we bond with them. But if they want to be joyful while we want to be quiet, and they want to be quiet when we want to be joyful, we don't bond with them because they're never on the same page. So if someone comes in, they're all excited, jumping around, and you're tired and you want to rest, you don't really enjoy their coming home. I mean, you might give them a faint smile and say, you know, go away, don't bother me. Or if you come bouncing around and you're full of joy and no one seems to care, you know, they just want to take a nap, again, you don't feel that closeness. We're looking for people who synchronize their joy and quiet with us, and those are the people that we really care about. And if we can synchronize those things together, we have our strength not only as individuals, but as a community. So a community is one that can synchronize their joy and rest together. Synchronization means that life and relationships take me individually into account. So synchronization, again, is personal. What happens in my life has something to do with me. It means that we share mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical states. This might be a little bit of news to you, but this is what we'll be talking about the next 2 hours. We do, in fact, share mutual mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical states. Matter of fact, when we are synchronizing with other people, our heart rates and skin temperature and things like that are going up and down, synchronized with theirs. And your brain has the capacity to do that. And this is what it means to synchronize energy states. Now, you all know that you can't deliberately and intentionally do that, right? So one of the exercises that we give people when we're running them through the exercises, we tell you, okay, deliberately move your heart rate up and down with to match the person across from you. And all of you, well, try it sometime just for the fun of it. We match energy levels in ways that respect the limits of younger and weaker people. So what that means is that the youngest, the weaker among us, has the most limit as to how much joy they can take before they need to rest. And if you rest when the weaker ones need to, then everyone can stay synchronized. And if we drive the weaker ones to try to match the strongest, you ever been hiking with a group of people and they couldn't all keep up? And after a while, it becomes fun for nobody because the stronger ones are always running on ahead. And by the time the weaker ones catch up, the stronger ones take off again, and the weaker ones get more and more and more tired. And it's like, I'm never going hiking with you ever again, because it isn't synchronized to the needs of the weaker ones. Our brain is very much that way. It also means that growth comes in stages in sequence with our needs. Now, after yesterday, you all know some of what that means, don't you? That the things that people will expect of you next in your growth is actually the next thing that would be good for you in your maturity. And it means that we stay relational as we change. You see, at the bottom of all of this, joy and quiet are both relational states. And so it seems as though whoever engineered our brains engineered us to be continuously relational. And one of the good ways to tell, are you malfunctioning, is you've lost your relational capacity. You're no longer relating to the other person. And that's what we'll be looking at today. Now, thriving itself means that we keep these life rhythms going. And I take a little quote here from the book that Chris and I are working on with called Thriving. Thriving is the visible sign of a well-synchronized life. And how well we thrive flows from the ways we synchronize our personal and relational rhythms. Thriving flows from keeping the basic rhythms of life. The corollary to that is that the unsynchronized life is painful. It is fairly safe to say that if you are experiencing pain in your life, or the person you're counseling or helping or praying for is experiencing pain in their life, one of their rhythms has gotten disrupted. One or more. And so restoring the rhythmic nature of what they were created to be. We'll take such a simple thing as disrupting somebody's digestive rhythms, you know. Upset that for a day or two. Or their sleep rhythms. I mean, those are basic ones, right? We're looking at those as basic physical rhythms, but we're talking now about the mental and spiritual rhythms of our life. When we thrive, we're synchronized. So staying synchronized is a way that people grow very well. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Now, the brain itself is a synchronization instrument. And it's synchronized at four plus levels. The four levels, the main four levels, are in the control center in the right brain, which we'll be talking about again more today. Both of our sessions, this one and the later one. And then as a bonus, if your control center is running well and well synchronized, your brain will throw in your left hemisphere. So the right hemisphere has got to get synchronized first, and if all that runs, then your left hemisphere with words and explanations and stories and all of your understandings and beliefs gets thrown in for a bonus. And though they're the same structures on both sides of the brain, they operate quite differently on the two sides of the brain. And the dominant side is the right side, the nonverbal side. What's over there is a control center that regulates our emotions. It does all of our synchronization. And that's the part of your brain that thinks of itself as you and contains your identity. It's always in charge of the brain. It's at the top of the command hierarchy. What does that mean? It's got the last word about everything. And if it takes over, it's quite capable of shutting down your left hemisphere and running things till it's done. We'll be looking at that in a little bit. But here's what typically happens. I'll give you the idea now so you'll have some place to put this. Let's say somebody was to get mad. At the point that they get angry and very emotional, their control center takes over. They say, this guy's upset. It shuts off his left hemisphere with all its beliefs, decisions, and things that he thought he and said he was going to do next time he got mad. That's all switched off. The control center now takes over, and it's on top of the command hierarchy. I'll run things until this upset is over. Now, because it's nonverbal, what it will do is it'll run tapes of all the things it saw done before under these conditions, what me and my people do. After you're through doing that and the problem's over, it'll switch on the other side that makes decisions and run things according to what you thought, planned, and said you were going to do. Now you can review it and see if what happened matched what you said you were going to do. You can see that would be a real problem if you filled that left side of the brain full of scripture verses, decisions, commitments, I'm not going to do this or say this again. And then you find that every time you actually get mad, that part of the brain goes blank, gets switched off, the control center runs tapes. And that's in fact how the brain is configured. Why you have to take the command center, this control center of the brain, quite seriously. And why an awful lot of what we do in Christian work, it goes to training the part of the brain that is gone when the problem shows up. That's what we're talking about today here. It shuts down the rest of the brain under high stress levels and runs the brain until the distress is passed. So that's what it means to be in command. It's in the right hemisphere, and it develops during the first 24 months of life. And it develops in four levels, and the levels start out developing first level 1, then level 2, then 3, 4, and so on as it goes along. And so they develop in a hierarchical way, and they function in a hierarchical way. Here they are. And so we're just going to look at them in terms of color coding them. Not going to do a whole lot with level 2. We're going to basically ignore it for the purposes of this lecture. Although some of you who are interested in things like dissociation and trauma and stuff like that, all that happens at level 2. We're leaving that out of this lecture series. Because although addicts can have that problem, we just don't have the time to go into it. What happens at level 1 and the problems at level 1 we're also not particularly going to be dealing with. It's what and who is personal to me. We talked about that yesterday in terms of creating your personal reality. But for your benefit and blessing, the last time I was here at ICBC 4 years ago, I did a series on level 1 and how to train it and retrain it. It's this Joy Bonds series here that actually talks about what you do with problems at level 1 that we're not addressing this time. So if any of you would like to do that, have a look at these tapes. I personally recommend them. I know the author. So level 2 tells us what to engage and avoid. Level 3 lets us match energy levels. What this now means in terms of what you've learned so far is that this is the part that helps us do joy when the people around us are in joy, and do quiet when the people around us are in quiet, and match those energy levels. Those are the two main ones that it wants to match to begin with. And it also lets us deal with the ones that we're going to talk about in terms of returning to joy. Level 4 does a sequence over time, so you can stay the same person over time. And then 4+ gives all your explanations, autobiography, and all the things that you say are true about yourself, which is, from the brain's point of view, quite dispensable when a real problem is running. Now, healing is more exclusively relational with each level down in the control center. So essentially, you can deal with 4+ levels without any real relationship at all. Very minimal relationship. I can teach you a principle. I can talk to you about something with, you don't really have to know me at all. You can take that principle, take and apply it. At level 4, you're going to be following my example. You'll see me as a role model. You can see how that's more relational, isn't it? You're now imitating me. And that's a more relational model. At level 3, we are going to share a common mental state that is so intense that neither you nor I can tell whether it's my state or your state. You and I become indistinguishable at that point. And as you move down to level 1, we form a bond which is going to last as long as we live in our human bodies. We will feel like we're bonded and connected to each other. So it's intensely relational. You become one of my, what we call, personal people. You will always be a meaningful person to me the rest of my life by the time we get down there. So the deeper we get, the more relational the healing is. Now again, this is something you don't generally see in Christian healing models. See? Because when we make things spiritual in America, we typically say we're making them non-relational. It has nothing to do with me, it's just you and God. Which, God is involved in all 4+ levels as far as I'm concerned. He created all of them, he's involved in meeting us at all 4+ levels. He doesn't consider one of those levels to be more spiritual than another, as far as I can tell. So let's start again with level 1 and look at the brain synchronization there. Move our way back up. You remember that we're talking about the basal ganglia and thalamus, which are the parts that create our sense of reality right there, as well as the ones that create our bonds, and they're very specific. They will not accept any substitutions, and they're part of what can cause us some of the most intense distress and depression when we lose the people that we care about. You see, our brain was not designed in any way to accommodate to death. Whoever designed the human brain did not design it to handle death. As far as it's concerned, the people it cares about should always be available and always alive. Now, this to me is one of the hugest arguments against evolution. If we evolved as a species, the first thing you'd have to adapt to is death, and there ought to be a huge mechanism inside there to handle this one, because it's pretty painful and it's upsetting and it really reduces your capacity to function. There's nothing built into the system to handle death. It's as though whoever built this thought that whoever owned the brain ought to live forever. And that is just not very adaptive, as anybody knows who's experienced death. Or had, well, if you've experienced it yourself. I'd like to thank Dr. Daniel Amen again for the brain scans. And if you want to get the information from him, you can go to thebrainplace.com. He's got this Healing the Hardware of the Soul, very interesting discussion on from a basically Christian point of view, although he tried to write it from a position that could be, you know, put out into culture without being too overtly Christian. And, you know, sometimes that's good, and sometimes, you know, we look at that and go, ah, why'd you bother? But anyway, it's a very useful book if you want to learn about everything from herbal to exercises to medications to biofeedback to brain scans to medication to diet that you can use to affect and get these different levels of the brain functioning right again. So if you've got a problem that's in one of these levels of your control center, he'll give you a series of exercises and diet and stuff like that you can do to improve the functioning of that part of your brain. Very useful, practical advice. And since you're not going to get it from me in this conference on that sort of thing, I suggest very much you go have a look at it. And, of course, I'm grateful that he lets me use his brain scans for my presentation. Now, what develops through attachment, this attachment level, is our relationships, the attachment circuit itself, the internal interpreter of others, which is called the virtual other mind sight. What that means is that our brain, by 5 months of age, develops the capacity to know that there's a mind behind the face that's looking at us. So we know that there's somebody back there. It isn't just a face. There's somebody back there. That ability is what you find greatly diminished in cases like autism and Asperger's and things like that, because they don't seem to know there's a person behind the face there. They don't relate to other people as though they were people. So, but this virtual other, this interpreter, is very important for us because it's a, like they say, virtual other, that's for computer people. It's a what other people are up to simulator. And so I can look at people and I see, well, that person looks interested. I think, well, they like what I'm presenting, you know. It might be that they're interested in what they're thinking about having after they leave here, you know. But I mistook their expression for something else. My virtual other fouled up its interpretation. But it's what lets me think something is going on back there. And that lets us relate to another person, very central to all of this. It also gives us the capacity to synchronize with others. You see, if it wasn't that we strongly desire to be in relationship with others and we're strongly in pain when we're not, we wouldn't have internally the motivation to relate to other people. I mean, you know, frankly, other people aren't that easy to get along with and synchronize with, especially in their fallen states. And if this wasn't the most powerful thing that we have driving us inside, we might, more of us, wander away from it. But as it turns out, none of us can wander away without being in significant pain. So it drives our capacity to synchronize with others and the motivation to repair broken attachments. Now, you see, here's exactly what we're going to talk about in terms of returning to joy. Everyone has the motivation to repair broken attachments. If the relationship that you're in broke down, you are in pain and you want to fix it. The only thing is, do you know how to fix it? And learning how to return to joy is learning how you actually practically fix it when something goes wrong. And what we're saying is that people who practice addictions, especially sexual addictions, have several significant gaps in knowing how to fix relationships when they go wrong. Okay, it went wrong. I know it went wrong. I'm in pain. I have no way to fix it. And so when you have no way to fix it, you want to find some way to make it stop. And that's where you end up with the addictions. This information comes especially about mindset out of The Developing Mind by Daniel Siegel. It's a book which I would say anyone who's a counselor, involved in counseling in any way from the year 2000 on, should know what's in this book. I believe that a decade from now, the whole counseling field will be changed, not specifically because of this book, but because of the information that's in here. A great deal of what has been done with counseling up until now will prove to be quite ineffective and obsolete, as indeed many people who've experienced counseling would tell you they kind of thought so. However, it's a bit hard reading and it's a little low on application, and so he wrote the second book with a teacher who actually knew the English language, and it's called Parenting from the Inside Out. And basically, if you wanted to say, if you can fix and repair the ways in which you experienced parenting yourself, so your internal model of how parents are and how they operate gets corrected, you'll be a better parent. And so fix what's running inside you. When you have your brain synchronized, it's sort of like take the log out of your eye and you'll see to be able to take the speck out of your child's eye, that kind of a theory of parenting. There's some wisdom to that. I'd recommend that book very strongly to anybody who had a parent. So, how does it all start? Well, we're going to look at synchronization starting with level 3 of the brain, which is the center part of the brain's 4+ levels of synchronization. This is the part of the brain that's involved with recovery when things go wrong. And so when we're talking about returning to joy or recovering, this is your part of your brain that needs to run right if you're going to do that. It's spiritually, it also is interested in synchronizing with God and recovering from what went wrong with God. Well, it wasn't with God that something went wrong, you understand. Our relationship with God had something go wrong with it. As a result, you see, we have been out of synchronization with God ever since. We're not on the same page. We're not doing the things that He's doing. And so our life has been lived in a, we're about a different business than God is. We're no longer synchronized. The brain region that we're talking about is the right cingulate cortex. And what it actually does is matches energy levels. What happens is if you match energy levels with other people, you create a shared state of mind. Because when you are at the same energy level with them and you're changing at the same rate that they are, you now find your thoughts and their thoughts indistinguishable, your feelings and their feelings indistinguishable. And that's what we're going to look at, these shared states of mind. And you're going to realize that they're a whole lot more common than you might have thought. If you don't do that well, you stay in distress. You have continuing states of distress, and it can be one of 6 emotions that you stay in distress in. So we'll be looking at those. Those are the 6 emotions you have to learn how to get back to joy from. You got a list of them yesterday, so some of you are ahead of this as well. When it malfunctions, you lose your relational capacity. You're no longer synchronized with other people around you. You're not relating to them anymore. You've stopped being relational. And pretty soon you will realize that in the people you're talking to and the relations that you're having, especially when they're getting upset, if you start to think about it, there's a point when people start getting upset, after which they lose their relational capacity. It's like they're no longer relating to you. They're no longer on the same page with you. They're now upset and they're running off someplace on their own. And if you ever tried to deal with somebody and you realize all of a sudden we're not connected here, you're just sad or upset, or it's like what I'm saying isn't making any difference to you. The impact that we're not... That's what we mean. The relational capacity is gone. You've malfunctioned at level 3 of the brain. And it's maintaining that synchronization with other people that is essential to our being relational with them. As soon as this malfunctions, then we are in a condition that's out of joy. And somehow we have to return to a condition where we can synchronize with people again. And that's what we'll be talking about here. In order to do this, you need trained minds. The only way that you can learn to resynchronize with somebody is to have an experience with someone who already knows how to do it and let your brain duplicate from their brain how they do it. It can't be taught to you didactically. All of the slides and everything I'm going to show you will not actually help you to do it the slightest bit. You can only learn it by actually doing it with someone who does know how to do it. And so that's very, very central there. It's that yellow banana-like shaped thing in the middle there called the cingulate cortex, which is the control level for two minds. The reason it's for two minds is that it will synchronize with one and only one mind at a time. I don't know if you've ever had the wonderful thing of having two people who are upset with you simultaneously about different things, and you realize you can't focus into what's going on with both of them. Your mind will only focus in at one at a time, and you can look at whoever you're looking at, you can be with them. But, you know, to be stuck between two people who both want your attention or both upset is a really, it's an unpleasant place to be, because your brain can only do one at a time. This is the facility that you're dealing with right there. And it synchronizes energy states, and the two that it likes to work with are the energy state of arousal, a high energy level, very active brain, called joy, and a quiet together state that we call peace. Now, let's look at what the synchronization center for the brain does, this mental banana. If we look at the back end of it, which is called the posterior cingulate, if you like your medical terms, that means the back end of it. The first thing it does is it synchronizes members of your own species. So it should be able to pick out from what all's going around who's another person. If you take that out of a monkey, you see, monkeys will sit on their own children as though they were rocks or objects. They can't distinguish that that's another monkey. Or any species at all, you take that out, any mammalian species in particular, they can't distinguish another member of their species from their own. With human beings, we have the story of the man who mistook his wife for the hat. He looked at his wife, recognized she's from something familiar from around the house, couldn't figure out what it was, thought maybe she was his hat, and kept trying to put her on his head because he had damage again to this thing, couldn't recognize her as a member of species. It also does nesting instinct. And so it's a very important to maternal responses that way. It does personal space. You know how you arrange yourself and don't bump into other people and you know, get into their space or not. You kind of know the people who don't have that part running right, don't you, right there? Yeah. Tracks eye movement. Very important. If you want to synchronize with other people, you want to pick out the ones that are looking at you. You ever notice that? You have sort of like the sense of someone's looking at you. You almost don't have to be looking at them, and something in your brain lets you know, I think they're looking at me. And it's a compelling feeling to want to turn around and look at them again, right? Every once in a while, this goes wrong for me. I'm in an airport or something, and someone's looking out to see if their flight is arriving. And I look back at them, and they see me looking at them. But then since I looked at them, and they're looking at me, it's like, well, they were looking at me, and he was looking at me. And it's like, well, one of us started it, you know. And it's like, well, it's hard to not look at them again, you know. It's like, okay, I'll stare at the airplane too. You know, I could care less about the airplane, but I'm trying to break up this very strong drive to look at those eyes that are looking at me. It also does dance movement. Which is the synchronized movement of two bodies in space involving energy. The most difficult of these is sexuality. As sexuality, you want to realize, in order for it to work right, you have to synchronize all kinds of energy levels and movements and time and space and match energy levels with somebody else. And if you get all that to match perfectly well, you have, you know, what people like. That's why it takes the average married couple about 10 years of sexual experience with each other before they can begin to fairly reliably match energy states in a sexual encounter. It's incredibly difficult to do. I call it dance movement because in some settings, I don't like to explain that part that I just told all of you. Might have children in the audience and stuff like that. But it's also what we use for sports and a lot of other things that require coordinated movements and energy with other people. And of course, dancing. And the front end of the cingulate then, called the anterior cingulate, or the front end, synchronizes the higher and lower brain functions. What does that mean? It means that it synchronizes levels 1, 2, 3, 4, and 4 plus of the brain together. And it makes all of that run right. It does joint emotions. We call that empathy, the capacity to feel what another person is feeling. Knock it out, and you no longer can feel or care about what other people feel. It does energy levels, which means you're able to be quiet when they're quiet and aroused when they're aroused. And what happens if you don't match energy levels? Okay. And let's say you're stuck on all the time. You remember? You know what we call that? Hyperactive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It also does mind sight. Lets you coordinate with other people and what they're thinking. It does joint activities or actions. And again, if you don't, you become oppositional and defiant. And if you have a level that's too low, you become overly compliant. And but in order to be cooperative with other people, this is what we want to do. It does joy smiles. These are the genuine joy. And it's the source of motivation for all internal and external action. If you knock the center of the brain out, people no longer are motivated to do anything at all. It's actually one of the novel treatments for intractable pain. What they do is they knock out a piece of this, and after that, the person who's in excruciating, intractable pain, if you ask them, are they still in pain, they say, yeah, it hurts as bad as before, but they just could care less and don't want to do anything about it. So it doesn't really treat the pain, it just treats your motivation to do anything about the pain. I actually had one of those experiences myself one time on nitrous oxide, laughing gas. They pulled my tooth, and it hurt like crazy. But I could care less. This part of the brain actually had been knocked out by the nitrous oxide. It was poisoned and wasn't running. And so while I can remember exactly how much it hurt, it's like I'm totally indifferent to the pain. A little example of that. And this is copied from your mother's brain between 2 and 9 months of age. This whole structure. Duplicated what's in your mother's brain during that time. And we're going to learn how. It happens based on this joy relationship right here. Joy smiles are what synchronize a mother and child from 2 to 12 months of age, and it involves what's called right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. Now, this gets a little complicated, so we'll leave this for some of the details you might be interested in, and then you can forget them quite quickly. But as some of you might know, everything that's on the left side of your brain goes to the right side of your body, and everything on the right side of your body goes to the left side of your brain, and you know, it does this little switch over from side to the brain. Have you heard of that before? Seeing some general nodding. Okay, it's always getting confusing, isn't it? Yeah, it gets worse. What's in your right brain then goes to the left side of your face. And there's an interesting thing that the emotions and this control center in your brain all get displayed on the left side of your face. But because it's your control center, it's only interested in your genuine emotions. So what you genuinely feel gets displayed on the left side of your face. Now, if I'm looking at you face to face, and I'm looking at your face, the left side of your face gets reflected on the left side of the retina of each of my eyes. And the eyes actually are split, each one of the eyes, so half of each eye goes to one side of the brain and the other half of the eye goes to the other side of the brain. What that ends up meaning is that the left side of the retina of each eye gets sent to the right brain. So all the information about your left side of your face ends up on the right side of my brain. So what this actually does then is it gives us right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. Whatever your right hemisphere feels and how it's reacting gets put on the left side of your face and registers on the right side of my brain. Your right hemisphere just sent my right hemisphere a direct message.
Is this true from lead to leukemia?
Yes. Handedness has no effect on this whatsoever. It's just the way all nervous systems run. Right hemisphere to right hemisphere synchronous communication. Now, what it wants to do is it wants to pay attention to your genuine feeling. Remember I said the joy smiles, the genuine smiles are in the cingulate? Your intentional smile, the smile for the camera, is on the side of your head, way out here someplace. And your real smile is on the inside. If you damage one place or the other, you'll be able to do genuine smiles, but not real, but not artificial smiles, or the other way around. This is Antonio Damasio's work, and here's a smile for the camera. We all recognize it, right? Outside of the brain, damage that part of the brain, you can't do these intentional smiles. And here's a joy smile. We all recognize this person generally feeling this. That's the cingulate. That's the mental banana working. And if you damage the banana, the genuine smiles disappear. That's what goes on your face right there, this genuine smile. Joy means we're glad to be together, and very specifically, someone's glad to be with me. It's the basis for strong bonds and secure attachments, and it's the only emotion that infants will seek on their own. So if you want to motivate an infant to do anything, this is the only thing they're motivated to do, is to seek and find joy. Now, you know, if an infant can do anything in the world, they will look at a human face. And if they can look at any part of the human face, they will look at the left side of the face. And if they can look at any part of the left side of the face, they'll look at the left eye. And the left eye happens to have the most information in it about what your genuine emotional state is. So babies are hardwired to look for the real, genuine emotional state of the person they're dealing with and establish right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. That is what happens through the synchronization center of the brain. Now, let's look at this in terms of a sender and a receiver. Okay? The information goes back and forth because once my right hemisphere gets something, it responds to it and sends it back to you. This happens in 6 complete cycles of communication every second. So what that means is my brain has had an emotional reaction, put it on the left side of my face, it went to your eyes, to your brain, to the left side of your face, back to my eyes and to my brain, and it did that 6 times before a second was up. All right? So again, I'm going to tax your mathematical skills. That's a 1/6 of a second, right, for a cycle. Now, a 1/5 of a second is actually longer than a 1/6 of a second. Are you aware of that? Yeah, because there's only 5 of them fits in a second. It takes a 1/5 of a second to be conscious of anything, 200 milliseconds. That means that whole message went and came back before I even had a chance to be conscious that a message went and came back. And in fact, I will have sent you my second message before I'm even aware that the first one came, sent and came back. So consequently, there's no conscious way that I can monitor, stop, or even be aware of what's happening. That's why it becomes a mutual mental state. It's running faster than I can be conscious of it. Consciousness only runs at 5 cycles per second, and this runs at 6. As a result of that, it's running so fast that in a matter of seconds, it's synchronized our brain chemistry. You are now producing the same kind of chemical response to our event as I am. And if our brains are growing, it's growing the same kinds of nerve endings, the same kind of places, the same kind of structures in one brain as it is in the other. We're exercising the same parts of our brain. This communication is always authentic, truthful, and as you can see, very rapid. And in addition, since it's emotional information, it's amplified every cycle. So if I send you a signal that's like a small joy, well, by the time you sent it back to me, you send it back louder than I sent it to you. And then I pick it up louder, and I send it back to you louder still. So these are amplified as they're going along. The same, by the way, works if you send me an anger signal. So next thing I know, we're both real angry, and we got angry before we knew when and how it happened. And they're subjectively experiences produced by the other. See, I know I wasn't consciously trying to do this, so you must have done it to me. You're making me mad. You're making me happy. You are doing this for me. It's a mutual mental state subjectively produced by the other. I experience that way. Before the visual cortex is ready to myelinate at about 6 weeks, babies are too young to do this. They can't see the other face clearly enough. So what they do is they give you this dead shark kind of stare if you try to smile at them. But by 3 months of age, and some as early as 6 weeks, if you smile at them, you get this response back. And now you know that these circuits are running and they're amplifying joy. I have most fun in restaurants doing this with kids. And, you know, even driving down the road, there'll be a stop sign. And I'll look over. There's a little baby in the baby seat, you know. And if I catch their eye, and we'll smile at them. And pretty soon, we're sending this back and forth. We have a great time. What's running this is this mental banana, or what's called the mother core, because the core of what it means to be a human being, and it's passed down from your mother by this kind of communication back and forth. Now, if you're looking at an older and younger brain, just to illustrate this a little more clearly, during critical periods of brain growth, the younger brain matches the older brain's chemistry. It duplicates the older brain's structures. And so in that sense, the older brain replicates itself in the younger brain. And whatever is not used and developed during the critical period of time is removed by the younger brain at the end of that time. So basically your brain has a use it or lose it principle going on. And if you don't use it, it gets deleted. So it's sort of a sculpturing process. For instance, if you didn't learn certain language sounds by a certain age, your brain will delete your capacity to say them. After that, if you learn the language, you'll always speak with an accent. You can't do that. If you don't learn to appreciate music by a certain age, your brain will delete the music circuits, and after that you can neither hear nor appreciate music as such. The same is the case with your joy and other systems in your brain. And some of the things that grow through the joy circuit are things like your serotonin and pain regulation circuits. They're all developed in response to joy. So if you don't use them by a certain age, they get deleted. And your brain no longer has the capacity to create the serotonin it would have before. And you're completely helpless because your brain, that part of your brain is now gone after the critical period of time is gone if it wasn't developed by the people around you. And the way it's developed is through this joy and quiet. Now here we have three children actually, and we've got three interesting states going on. Now one of those has got a smile for the camera. Can you pick out the smile for the camera? Yes, you can. See, you've already distinguished your cingulate from other activities you got. You're so good. Now, one of these babies, they're twins, one of them has eye contact with the mother and is being amplified, and the other doesn't. Can you pick out which one has eye contact and is having the right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication? The one on the left, right? The other one's anticipating it, but anyone can tell by looking at those children that doesn't have eye contact yet, right? You can see I'm waiting for it. But you can now, you know, subjectively we all know this stuff. But you've never been told about it before, so you wouldn't maybe put it in words. But you know which one is doing right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication by just looking at the picture of the children. Here's a baby at moderate joy level, halfway up to their maximum. And here's a 13-month-old at high joy. When babies reach high joy level, their arms fly out to the side, and they look away, and they, you know, they get wiggly and all that sort of stuff, because at the top of your joy level, you reach the most that your nervous system can handle. And when you get above that, it's like being tickled too long. You just can't stand it. And so babies, you know, signal that they've had all they can handle. Now, does joy have anything to do with God? I don't know. But Isaiah does say that you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. So whoever was promising the people that this is a blessing, isn't it? Whoever thought to bless people this way thought that they were addressing the kind of people whose nervous systems would inherently like joy and peace. See? So that's what I keep saying. Whoever designed the nervous system had something to do with the inspiration of Scripture. You know, because if you promised people anything else, they wouldn't inherently like it or want it. Or, you know, why would that be a blessing? But these are the two things that your nervous systems craves more than anything else. And it says you're going to go out in joy and peace. That's wonderful. Joy is also why Jesus spoke to us. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy might be full. So what kind of joy was Jesus aiming at? Little joy? Whatever we can get by with joy? He's trying to have those your circuits running at maximum capacity, isn't it? Big time joy is what he's aiming at here. And he says that's the reason for his teaching. I remember this is the Last Supper just before he's crucified. So this is a pretty important lecture. He's saying this is why I've come to teach. Now, again, as I said in the opening soundbite, I grew up in the church. My parents were missionaries. This was new to me after I had read the science about joy, I went back to see if it was in Scripture. And that's the first time I ever saw this passage. And I was shocked, as many Christians since have been. Like, this is actually why Jesus came? I got all kinds of other reasons why he came. But at a very crucial time, he said, I came, and this is what I want to convey to you, a joy. And if joy all of a sudden means we're glad to be together, as far as your nervous system is concerned, could that make a good deal of sense to the redemptive story? Could you say, Jesus came so that and taught these things so that we could really be glad to be together? Does that sound like salvation to you? It does to me. Okay, well then his high priestly prayer, when he's praying to God just before he goes out to face his betrayer, he says, but now I'm coming to thee, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. So once again, he's saying, this is what I hope to leave behind as my legacy in his final prayer before he dies. Thankfully, it didn't last long. I don't mean the joy, I think, is staying dead. Why Jesus said we should pray. Hitherto you've asked nothing in my name. Ask that you will receive that. All right? Is that the outcome of the prayer meetings in your church? Joy is why we fellowship. Though I have much to write with you, I'd rather not use paper and ink. Hope to come and see you and talk with you face to face so that our joy might be complete. Now, we already know that your nervous system responds face to face to joy. That's how it happens. You know, by the way, it won't work if you look in a mirror. If you look in a mirror, you'll get right to left communication. You cannot amplify yourself. You have to look at another person. The only mirror that accurately reflects you is another human face. So we are designed to only be able to see ourselves accurately as reflected in the eyes of another human being. We are to be each other's joy. What's our hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming? Is it not you? For you are our glory and joy. Now, I dare say that if this wasn't in Scripture and I came and said to all of you that we should be each other's glory and joy, most of us would piously say, no, no, God should be our glory and joy. It shouldn't be you. But here's the Apostle Paul, who I take to be somewhat of an authority on the subject, and he says that we are to be each other's glory and joy, the people that we are filling with life. It's also the youngest emotion in Scripture, for behold, when the voice of your greeting came to my ear, the babe in my womb leapt for joy. And with that note, let's get up and take a little stretch, and we will regroup in about 5 minutes. If you go very far, I am starting in 5 minutes again, with or without you.
This one that's on the stuff.
The Thriving Book?
Yeah.
It won't be before the end of the year. That'd be the fastest. Okay, are we rolling again? Yes? Okay, action. I see the thumbs up there. Right. First year of life, the task is joy. Now you understand what joy is about, at least an overview, but let's look at how that joy is actually developed with a little technical detail here. The way it's done is by synchronizing stimulus intensity. So we'll talk a little science here. That sounds pretty scientific right there? Synchronizing stimulus intensity. Okay, what that means is that I synchronize the joy in our lives and our brains by how strongly or intensely I express my feelings to you. So we look at this mother here in this case with the two twins. And again, one of them has got eye contact, direct eye amplification, and the other doesn't. Can you tell me which one? Yes, we can tell who's got eye contact and who doesn't. And the mother has got the smile on her face that says, let's play joy. Right? This is a big, what it's called, a big target in the literature. That's what's coming out of the synchronization center in the this mental banana, or what we call the mother core. Now, let's look at the difference between good and bad mothers and what happens here. Now, every conference I do, I have some people later want to take me outside and stone me because I talk about good and bad mothers. I understand that the great sacred cow of America is mothers, and that no one should ever be able to say the word bad mother. It's not a word that I made up. It's a word that comes out of the literature, and what it means is a mother whose style creates a bad brain in their child, a non-working brain, malfunctioning brain in their child. It's not a moral judgment. As you'll soon see, you can only pass on that which you have received. That which I receive, I pass on to you. If you received a bad banana, you're going to pass on a bad banana. There's no way to do anything other, because it's downloaded, as you saw, faster than you can consciously track. And so there's no way consciously you can alter this process. And you can only pass on that which you've received. And so some people have received a bad banana, and they're going to pass on a bad banana unless they take some corrective steps. And when you pass it on, you do some things wrong. And that is called bad mothering. So I'm not meaning to cause a moral judgment about anything. I'm just saying this doesn't work. And the way it works to get it right is by stimulation and quiet. Synchronization requires both stimulation and rest, right? If we were going to synchronize with each other and we were going to clap together, right? We would have to have noise and quiet, noise and quiet. If it was continuous quiet, can you synchronize your clapping with me? Yeah. No, you have to have the alternating. A few of you said you could do better with that one. Okay. What you synchronize in your brain is joy and quiet. Now, you see this person here, this the girl. She is at the point of withdrawing. She's saying, I'm overloaded. I'm ready to take a break and rest. This is a child. Just reach the I'm ready to rest now. Don't smile at me anymore stage. The effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness, quiet and trust forever. By the way, this is something for you to remember if you want to ever build trust. Trust is built by allowing people to rest when they need to. If you have people who you know will let you rest when you need it, you will soon grow to trust them. And that should be kept in mind when people are doing things in churches and stuff like that. We often get a lot of work done and not much trust built. But the effect of righteousness will be peace and quietness. Now, here's the difference between a good and bad mother. We're going to look at them here. The upper graph is a bad mother. I mean, it's a bad mother, an unsynchronized bad mother. And what you're looking at a graph of is heart rates. So the difference between a good and bad mother can be mapped out on their heart rates. What happens here at the beginning of time, we see here, this is the mother's heart rate. It's coming in, it's an elevated heart rate. She's at a higher energy state. And here's her baby down here, brain dead. Just kind of laying there, nothing going on, and a very unaroused state, as babies get to when there's nothing happening. Then, the mother, what she's doing is smiling at the baby. And as she begins to smile, the baby's heart rate goes up until it reaches that point called gaze avert. That's scientific for look away. And at that point, the baby's had all, and she looks away. But what does the mother continue doing? She continues smiling at the baby, even though the baby looked away, overstimulating the baby until the baby begins to cry. It's only at the point where the baby registers pain that the mother suddenly disengages, walks away, and in fact is absent from the child's experience. Now what happens then is that the baby needed rest at the point that they looked away, but they didn't receive rest. Now let's look at what a good mother would do. She comes in at a higher energy level than the baby does too. She's got a big smile on her face. The baby is down here, essentially brain dead. And then what happens is very interesting. As the baby begins to respond, the mother immediately drops her heart rate down to match that of the child's. And then they match heart rates and increasing heart rates over the next several seconds. As the baby goes up, the mother goes up. As the baby's energy goes up, the mother's energy goes up. And then when the baby does the gaze avert, the mother immediately drops her heart rate to a very low level and looks away and disengages. Now, what we're saying is your brain knows how to do this. You can, in fact, match heart rates with somebody if your banana knows how. So we look at one banana knows how and the other banana doesn't know how. But as you're thinking about it consciously now, and most of you are going, I wonder if I could do that, you realize that if I told you to all go out of here and your secret to effective heart counseling was to match heart rates with people, none of you could consciously choose to do that because all of that's in your left hemisphere up at level 4+. And this happens in your brain at level 3. And unfortunately, anything that goes in at 4+ does not go back down to level 4 or 3 or 2 or 1. Only the things that go in at level 1 can go up and affect the higher levels. So if you match heart rates, it will affect what you think at level 4+. But if you change how you think at 4+, it won't change your heart rate. You see how that works and how one kind of system will work and what won't. In order to effectively begin to return people to joy, you have to have a running, operating banana. And so counseling training and parenting training should involve banana training. And I want to tell you that we have, by the end of the time we're done here, you'll be interested in banana training. And I have the director of the International Banana Growers Association here with us today. And if you would stand, Jen, in the back. The Banana Growers Association is in its infancy, but I would suggest that you might want to contact her. And I believe it's at the care table, right? and you can give her your information and things like that. And she can help you get in contact with the just the beginning things that we're doing in this area. Again, I will tell you this, there is no distribution system through the world that exists outside the church for distributing these kind of skills to people who don't have them. But as you will soon see, there's a way to learn them and pass them on and to fill the holes that were left in your bananas training. And once you learn how to do that, one of the things is that it has to start with a group of people that have joy to be together. And if that's actually the characteristic of the church is the only place where you can begin to do this. And then you will see it has to do with people who are willing to get back to joy together when something has gone wrong. That is to say, a group of people who believe in a redemptive process that can restore those with whom a relationship has been ruptured. And again, that should be the church, right? Except I would ask you, does the average church run that way? And I would say that the answer isn't so much that their theology is off, but they all have bad bananas and nothing has been done to correct that problem yet. You can see if you've got a better answer for me. So what's the difference between the good mother and the bad mother? It's simple. The good mother smiled more than the bad mother smiled more than the good mother did. And characteristically, if you want to tell the difference between the good and the bad mothers, the good mothers are smiling more than the bad mother. The good mothers are smiling less than the bad mothers do. The primary symptom of bad mothering is more smiling than the baby can take. In other words, we are overstimulating what their nervous system can have. We didn't bring them to quiet when they needed quiet. And again, that's also the characteristic of the average church, you know, that's big and growing and exciting, but no one can rest or be quiet around there. We bring them to a lot of excitement, but we never have quiet together, you know. Again, you remember that's what Ezekiel said was the difference between the good and bad shepherds. The bad shepherds, he says, drive even the strong sheep with ruthless severity, but the good shepherd takes the strong sheep out to play. Well, here's the actual research studies. You see, on picture A there, the baby looks kind of brain dead, right? And there's mother in the corner with this great big smile on her face that says, let's play joy. That's at high arousal level. If we look at picture B, you'll see the baby's beginning to smile and mother no longer is smiling as big as she did. She's lowered her heart rate and those things to match the baby's. Then at picture C, you see the baby look away and her arms fly out to the side. That's gaze avert, that's when I've had enough, we've got the top of joy, and then the quiet together starts in picture D, and if you look at mother, she almost looks like someone's died. Baby's looking down, but doesn't she? She looks pretty flat. She almost instantaneously went to an extremely low arousal state, turned everything off right on a dime. Now, baby doesn't know how to do that at first, and so the baby has to coast slowly down to a low arousal state. But as they practice this more and more, the baby also begins to learn how to quiet himself on a dime. This ability to quiet yourself quickly is what you learn out of quiet together. And this is the study by Field and Fogel in Shore's Origin of the Self, page 86. This is his book right here. And he's the person who put together all of the science and development and a variety of different fields all into one. He spent an enormous amount of time for years and years in libraries putting things together. Consequently, he's been called the Einstein of psychiatry. So here we have a father in this case in a high arousal state and the baby in a low arousal state getting ready to play joy and start the right hemispheric amplification. And this is that big target we're talking about. This is mommy saying, let's play joy, getting the baby jump started. And then as they amplify it, the baby reaches a high arousal state, and when they get to the top, then they stop and rest. Here's another one of the original studies. This was by Beebe and Lachman in 1988. This time, mother starts the baby out with a kissy face stimulation, and in B, you see they're going through B, C, D, E, until they get to F. And at F, you see the baby looks up and left. Now, why the baby look up and left? Because if you look to the left, you disconnect right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. That's the most effective way to break off from the right hemisphere is to look that way. And so that's why they will look to the left. That's also what you will notice if you're talking to a man and he wants to concentrate. If he can, he'll look off and to the left. because most men can't talk about something and be in right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication at the same time. The emotion of talking to a woman in particular, whatever their emotional state is, distracts them so much that they can't get into left hemispheric autobiographical memory to remember who they are and what they wanted to say unless they disconnect right hemisphere. So they'll think about it and then they'll come back to talking to you. It's like, you know, give me a break here a second, I got to think. So when you get this synchronization going, then what it does is it creates matched mental states, matched energy levels. It alternates between arousal and rest, and that's synchronized to the baby by good mothers, and it matches the mother's needs for bad mothers. In other words, another way to say it is a good mother will match the baby's capacity, and a bad mother will demand that the baby match the mother's capacity and needs. You smile for me, as opposed to that I smile for you. It's about the only difference right there, and that's how you can really tell how to build a good brain. And that's why synchronization always has to match the capacity of the lesser brain. You would find a very interesting thing if you went through the Bible and studied the responses to seeing God's face from Genesis to Revelation, and how that would match with what we're talking about, the capacity to handle seeing a face and matching the joy on God's face, if you put that into the equation. In Genesis, we can see God's face. By the time of Moses, he's afraid he's going to die if he looks at it. It'll be completely blown out. And by end of Revelation, we are again gazing at God face to face again. We have returned to joy. Okay, now the difference between the good and bad mothers is that one of them pays attention to the need to rest, and that creates quiet together. Here's a good mother. They're both in low state. They're medium, and then just before disconnect to rest, the baby's at a high joy level. Here's a bad mother. Happens to be a man this time. But if you look at this man, he's trying to get a smile off of the baby, right? Now, what do you see on the baby's face? Is that joy? No. Actually, his baby has never seen this guy before. It's a cousin. But the cousin thinks he wants to make the baby smile. Why? Because he needs the baby to smile for him. So instead of synchronizing to the baby's actual emotion, which is, I'm scared of you, I don't know who you are, he is now going up and actually trying to touch the baby's face to stimulate the baby farther to see if by stronger stimulation you can't make this baby smile for me. So he's completely unsynchronized. He's trying to get the baby to smile for him. And so he's got that smile on his face that has a little bit of nervousness to it right there as well, because that's what a bad mother would do. Synchronizing, you see, is very hard work. It's the toughest thing that a baby's brain can actually do. It's their maximum workout. And if you synchronize rest cycles, you also get the capacity to rest between each other. You see, those rest times, the way that you lower your heart rate is by switching on all the serotonin nerve endings in your brain. And so if you exercise your serotonin nerve endings, you grow and develop and keep them. And you learn how to turn them on every time you need them. And if some of you know anything about depression, what do we give people who are depressed? We give them serotonin stimulate, something that will raise their serotonin level. It's actually giving them something that will compensate for the inability to enter into a state of rest and quiet together. They're not able to quiet their distress. But that is what happens during that quiet together. You learn to turn it on immediately and quickly like your mother did. A good mother teaches a child to quiet themselves. And this capacity to self-quiet is the best predictor of mental health for a lifetime. So by studying whether or not a child's first 24 months had a good experience of quiet together or didn't, will predict their mental health for a lifetime more strongly than any other factor you can pull out. Scripture says, I have calmed and quieted my soul like a child quieted at its mother's breast, like a child that is quieted is my soul. There's a spiritual value to being able to quiet oneself as well as the survival value. Now the way that happens then is by repeated practice. You see, if you practice this circuit, use it only once, you get a very tiny little circuit growing in your brain. But every time you use that circuit again, you're able to handle a larger and larger level of joy and larger signal inside your brain and go to higher and higher levels of joy. And just like it would be practicing an exercise, we can scan your brain and find out how big your joy structure is inside. How much did you grow? It's an actual physical structure that developed according to how much work it got. And if it's very small, you can't handle very much joy, and consequently, you can't quiet very much distress. So your ability to handle joy determines how much distress you can handle later on in life. It's a locked formula as far as your brain is concerned. That way we can say that our joy biologically is our strength, and in Scripture we find the joy of the Lord is our strength. And in the next verse it says, so the Levites stilled all the people by saying, be quiet, for this day is holy, and do not be grieved. And so the strength is being used to quiet their distress, and immediately the next verse. So again, we're looking at a joy which is used to quiet our distress. And in fact, that is precisely how whoever designed the nervous system set it up. Again, making me think that whoever wrote Scripture knew how the nervous system worked and maybe had some hand in developing it. So now we're ready to look at returning to joy, which is this quieting of this distress. It's developed from 12 to 18 months of age. So the second year of life task is called returning to joy, which is what we want to get to. This 13-month-old can synchronize at high joy levels and is ready to learn to synchronize at high distress levels as well. Returning to joy means we're reconnecting with someone who made me feel distressed. And so if you look at this feeling, it's one of the big six, and it's the one that we recognize as hopeless despair. Returning to joy means that we're resynchronizing with someone that's out of tune with me, or specifically recovering from someone who is not glad to be with me. If joy means we're glad to be together, then what causes us distress and upset is that someone isn't glad to be with us. They respond to us with anything other than joy. That means that we have to find someone who's glad to be with me in my distress, even if they were the cause of it, which in the case of parents, they usually are, and who's willing to share my distress and help me to quiet myself or regulate that. They're actually willing to show me how their brain does it so that I can follow them. Good mothers do this starting about a year of age. They'll spontaneously begin to create negative emotions like shame in their infants. Shame is produced when mommy responds with disgust, unhappiness, anger, or something else instead of joy to what the baby has done. Up until then, you see, mothers with good bananas, baby can do just about anything. And the mother just laughs and carries on. But about a year of age, something switches inside the mother's brain. It's a well-developed banana. And all of a sudden, she's not putting up with everything all the same, and she's not happy with everything the baby does, and sometimes she's just upset. And so, you know, the classic example, baby sticks hand down inside a diaper, brings out something warm and squishy that he created to show mommy a wonderful thing he's done, and mommy's not happy with it, face registers disgust, baby's shocked, there's no joy there to see him, all of a sudden, because someone isn't glad to be with him, baby's in a state of shame and wants to withdraw from that face that isn't glad to be with him. Now what a good mother does is she goes from disgust to shame, her face also, her right hemisphere takes and amplifies the shame, registers it on the left side of her face. Baby now sees that mother also is feeling the same shame that the baby is. And by matching the chemistry, they go from that back to being glad to be together again. And so by duplicating those steps, by just tracking it 6 times per second in these little cycles, the baby learns how your brain goes from point A to point B. And after that, they learn to do it the same way they learn how to speak and say words, by kind of following you from point A to point B. And pretty soon they're saying the same words that you are, making the same sounds that you are, duplicating the same way back to joy that you used. And so whatever they see done is what they will duplicate, and they'll produce the right chemistry and physical structure. And although there might have been capacities to do other things at the end of the critical time, your brain goes through and deletes them. So you're left with whatever capacities that you got handed on to you. So we look at it this way with a sender and receiver, and we have these messages going back and forth. They're synchronized now to negative emotional states, and the baby learns to stay in relationship while learning to calm the distress. And that's, of course, the essence of returning to joy. You stay in the relationship. It matches the child's brain chemistry and wiring to the adult's at a rate of 6 cycles per second, and it's subjectively experienced as produced by the other. The mother would say, the baby's making me mad, and the baby would say, mommy's making me mad. But the actual fact is they are sharing a mental state that they're amplifying in each other, and it's going so fast, neither one of them can keep track of who's doing it. Which, by the way, is any of you gotten into one of those mutual states with somebody, you realize that, you know, it feels like they're doing it to you. You know, you're making me mad. It's really subjectively how it feels. Now, you learn to do your self-regulation to calm yourself by doing it first with somebody else. So unless you have this mutual experience, you can't do it for yourself later. They're both needed, however, throughout the lifetime. We are continuously experiencing kinds of experiences that we've never had before. And as soon as we get ourselves into a new mess like we've never been in one quite like this before, we need somebody who knows how to handle this and act like themselves in this way, in this one to show us the way. So we get people who, you know, they get into a new experience of counseling, and all of a sudden they get their first demon that manifests, and it produces all kind of feeling inside of them, and they start looking around immediately for somebody who's done this before to show them what do we do now. You know, we want to act, we want somebody who's tried this one before, and when we do, we're much reassured, and we'll say, well, let's see how you handle it. I mean, the same thing happens with almost anything, including sports, you know, and or anything with a challenge. We want somebody who's done it before. This mutual regulation is needed for two things. One, it's learning to return to joy. And the second is for combining joy strength. You see, one of the little known things is that if you're in a synchronized state, you actually have essentially the combined joy strength of both brains with which to handle the distress, because it's a mutual state. So if you are kind of low in joy, but you're linked in a synchronized state with somebody who's high in joy, you've got a lot more brain capacity right at that moment to handle the distress of life than you would if you were by yourself. We actually physically in this way can share each other's burdens if we have a joyful bond with one another. If we don't have joy and trust with each other, we don't have a connection. It won't work, because this part of the brain only wants to bond or connect with people that we trust. So you see, this mutual regulation develops the capacity to do it for yourself afterwards. It means we're synchronized at our mother core. This level 3 has got, it's a mutual state going on. And then the prefrontal cortex, which we learn about next session, is supervising, and we're in a state of right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. And it's entirely nonverbal. So you ask, what do I say, what do I do? Well, it has nothing to say with what you're thinking. It's all running too fast for you to consciously do it. You either know how or you don't. And so what we're beginning to look at is, how do you become aware of what you do and don't know how to do? And the list of things you need to know how to do is very short. Again, from the nice biology here developed by Dr. Shore, we find, and I won't go particularly into the lateral tegmental or the ventral tegmental circuits, other than to say one's sympathetic and the other's parasympathetic, and already most of you don't care. But on the one side, we have the arousal states that are terror and rage. And joy, by the way, is an arousal state. And on the energy decreasing side, we have shame, disgust, and hopeless despair. Shore recognizes these 5 states. And because this is his grid, I'm giving you 5. I say there's 6. And so do a number of others like Siegel, because they say that sadness is its own state. Now, Shore says that sadness is a lesser state of hopeless despair. So the theoreticians are arguing back and forth. Is sadness and hopeless despair the same or different? He says the same, so you're looking at his list. He comes up with 5. I'm giving you the list that most the rest of us go with, and that's a list of 6. We would include sadness on the energy decreasing side as its own feeling separate from hopeless despair. Whatever the case might be, whether you have, you can do 5 or 6, that's the list. Those are the ones you have to get back to joy from. If your brain can do those, you've got it all. And so the training is really relatively limited. And what we're going to look at now is what's involved in training you to be able to do those specific things. It's one or more of those 6 that we say addicts are unable to do. And whenever that one shows up in their relationship, instead of being able to restore a relationship, they go and practice their addiction. And so to be able to get them out of that mess, you have to be able to show them how to get back to joy from whatever one it is. And that's why you have Shore's book, which is called Affect Regulation and the Repair of the Self. Affect regulation means nothing more than being able to calm your emotions. And he says the way you repair your sense of self is by learning to calm your emotions. Now, here's returning to joy from rage, as you might remember from yesterday's video. You see the baby's mad because mom wants to take the spoons away. And you notice from the mother's forehead that she's got a scowl there. She's entered into the rage state with the baby just before this picture was taken. And then if you look down at her lower lip, you realize that's not an angry lower lip, right? We all know that. We don't know how we all know that. It's because our banana is telling us. And by the way, if you've got a defective banana, you often misinterpret faces. For instance, you may interpret sad or tired faces as being angry, and you get the information wrong. Now, by the way, if you try to repair a relationship with somebody and they're tired, but you're treating them like they're angry, will the relationship repair very well? No. So having a bad banana can put you on the path of fixing the wrong thing, which really doesn't help people, because you keep telling them, yeah, you're mad at me, or you're mad at me. You're going, I'm tired, and I'm not mad at you. Yes, I know you're mad at me. And pretty soon you are mad at them, you know, because you've finally picked up their angry state, and you're amplifying it too. So you keep this up, you're going to have me mad enough at you. And okay, now we know how to fix this. And it's amazing. They're relieved now. Okay, you're mad. Okay, fine. Okay, now good. Now I know how to do this one. So they've gotten you out of whatever. You just needed rest, and they didn't recognize it, you see, because another thing they don't know how to do is to let you rest when you need it. So again, the banana's giving them wrong information. So here we have somebody in rage, and then in less than 10 seconds, they've both gotten back to joy. And as you notice, Mom got the spoons. Returning to joy means that we will stay relational under distress, act like ourselves, and that means that no matter which emotion we're in, we stay the same person. So we remain the same person over time. In order to do that, we have to focus the flashlight of our awareness on the lesser mind. Now, the lesser mind, I don't mean the dumb bunny. I mean the less well-developed mind, the one who hasn't had the attention yet. So let's say I wanted to teach you how to get back to joy from anger, and I'm really mad at you. Now, normally, if someone's really mad at you, where is the flashlight of your attention going to go? Right on the person that's mad at you, right? Someone comes in and starts yelling at you. All of a sudden, you forget all about yourself. You start paying attention to you, like what's going on with you, and your mind is focusing on you and how to get you to stop. So the flashlight of your attention is on the other person, and what happens when your flashlight of your attention is on the other person, you're not learning a thing about yourself. You're learning a lot about them, nothing about you. So in order to get someone to learn how to return to joy, you have to put the flashlight of attention back on them. And you say, well, what is it like for you when I'm this mad at you? What do you need? Are you getting a little overwhelmed? Maybe I need to let you rest a little bit here so that you can catch your breath, and then I'll come back and be mad at you again. All right, good. Okay, well, take your breath. Okay. Now, I'm still mad at you. Now, what else do you need? And since no one has ever done that with us, most of us haven't a clue of what we need or what we want, or how would you like this to turn out? You know, how would you like to resolve it? Well, we know what, last time someone was this mad at you, how did you work it out? What's your preferences? What are your style? You know, what do I need to accommodate for you? And the greater mind needs to address that to the younger mind. But since that almost never happens when people are angry, because they've got bad bananas, they don't know how to get back to joy. The older mind hardly does that ever for the lesser mind, right? But if we're teaching the lesser mind how to eat, we'd keep the attention on them, right? Okay, now, no, get your spoon in there, put it in your mouth, don't throw it on. We'd be paying attention to them and what they were doing. The same thing would have to happen here. The focus of the attention has to be on the lesser mind. Now, we say Jesus acted like himself when he was having a powerful rage. There's only one place in Scripture it registers that Jesus was in a powerful rage. Do you know where it was? Okay, good Christian audience, they all say in the temple, when he's throwing the money changers in that story, right? Yeah. Actual fact, Scripture says nothing about what Jesus felt in the temple. He may have been in a rage, he may have been anything else, but Scripture doesn't actually say. So we've gotten a lot of mileage out of that one. Uh-huh, yes, okay.
When he's going to heal the man with her hand, he looked around as if with anger.
And the anger that he had is called orgy. Now, all the non-Greek scholars always ask me if that has anything to do with orgy. It just happens to sound like it. It's no relationship at all to the word. But anger, this orgy, is such an intense anger that it's on this list of sins in Colossians 3:8. Now, put them all away, and it starts out with anger. And interestingly enough, every place in Scripture, aside from this, where the word orgy turns up and people are this angry, they're trying to kill someone. So it's a level of rage that led people every time we have it recorded to kill somebody. So Jesus, in this case, flew into a powerful rage, and he got so mad he had to heal the guy. That's what the story tells us. Now why? Because he acted like himself, right? Suppose he had looked around and everyone was so full of faith and were looking at him with great joy and he was filled with joy. What would he have done? He would have healed the fellow, right? Suppose that they were a scary looking crowd and they looked like they were going to throw him off the hill and look kind of scary out there. What would he have done? Healed them all. See, because he acted like himself. And it's for lack of knowing what it's like us to do that we don't know how to act like ourselves under these kind of conditions. And so Jesus can, in fact, experience that kind of rage. But you see, he wasn't a killer. He had come to bring life. So when he acted like himself, whatever he had to do was had to bring life. Because at his heart, he wasn't a killer. Now, if we get into a complete rage and we're experiencing ourselves as killers, what we're going to do is what? We're going to kill somebody, which is what people did to him, as I recall. So, returning to joy is learned between 12 and 18 months of age through mutual regulation of shared emotional states using right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. Here's returning to joy from sad, again within 10 seconds, or from fear, the baby that was frightened by the sound of the leaves. Now, here's an interesting picture. If you look at this baby's face and look at the left and right sides, you notice a different feeling on the two sides? The right side of the face is starting to get back to joy faster, the intentional side, what the baby's thinking is, this isn't so bad. But the other side, you can tell, is still more upset. The right hemisphere, the genuine emotion of the child, is upset. And up until the child's about 4 years of age, the two sides of the head are almost completely unconnected. It's like having two brains in there operating separately. So you can see one of those moments when you got the two brains operating separately, and this baby is still upset, looks up at mother, will it kill me? Locks into mother's eyes, and after seeing what mother does with that leaf, in a few minutes, actually less than a few minutes, the baby is now having a fun time playing in those fall leaves. Return to joy. Direct neurological paths back to joy from distress allow a quick resolution of the distress without avoiding negative feelings. In other words, you can get back to joy in about 90 seconds. Now, the fact that most Americans can't get back to joy can be proved by from shame, for instance, can be proved by one simple thing. They still are watching I Love Lucy. I Love Lucy has, by and large, only one plot line. Lucy gets into one situation or another that's going to cause her shame or embarrassment. All the rest of the story is built around her avoiding having to feel shame or embarrassment, which ultimately will catch up with her at the end of the story. And then she'll just have to be ashamed or embarrassed, and it'll all turn out all right because Ricky will say whatever he does. Now, the fact of the matter, that's utterly boring if within 90 seconds you could return to joy from shame. You'd look at that story and go, that's dumb. Why should I watch somebody avoid shame for the next half hour? But it's so motivating to humans in America that we're still running reruns in black and white of somebody running away from their shame feelings. And everyone can relate to it because so many people say there's no path back to shame in their brain that it makes sense to them that Lucy will do all the nutty things she does to avoid it. But if you could get back, you'd really couldn't stand the show after just a few seconds. Where there's no path back to joy, we see the avoidance of specific negative emotions, sidetracks into other feelings. Fear might go into rage, sad, or sex. And here's where we get the sex addicts again. Because there's no path back to joy, they go back to the thing that produces a mental equivalent of joy, and they say, I have a path back to orgasm. And sometimes it'll involve another person, and that's a substitute for returning back to joy. So when there's no path back to joy, but they know a path back to orgasm, especially if it involves an individual, then it's closer to joy. But if there's no individual, that it can be a fantasy individual, and then it's a path back to joy. They are, in fact, giving you a non-productive way of solving this brain problem of how to get back to joy from any feeling, most commonly sad or shame. And when there isn't a path back, you find people also in extended periods of disturbance like distress. Now, your ability to get back to joy depends entirely on how much joy you've developed along the way. So, let's say you have a medium level of shame, and you've had five practices of building joy, and you have a medium level of shame. It could come in any intensity, but this is a medium one, right? If you've had five practices, can you get back to joy? I put joy camp up there at the top of the hill. won't get back, right? Your nervous system can't handle this shame. It'll shut down. Can't handle a signal that strong. If you had 50 practices, you won't be able to. How about if you'd had 500 practices? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. That's more than enough. I'm pausing here for tape. All right, so here we have a mild level of anger. Again, anger could come in a lot of different intensities. But now who can make it back to joy camp? The person with 5? Not quite. How about the person with 50 practices? They got enough strength to get back, and so does one with 500. Oh, here we got a deep despair. It's a strong one. Now, it wouldn't have to be strong, but in this particular case, we have a strong one. Can any of these people get back to joy from that? Anyone got enough joy strength? No, not even 500. What's going to happen to this experience of deep despair? Well, it's quite simple. It won't be able to be kept in their conscious mind, because any time they try to load it into their conscious mind, it will upset their capacity. It'll blow their circuits, and their brain will shut down on them. It'll desynchronize. And so it will stay in there, not able to think about this consciously mind, until some point later in their life where they might develop a strong enough joy capacity that now it will load into their brain, and for the first time this memory will come popping back into their brain, and with it the intense sense of shame that went with it. Because up until now, it's been too overwhelming for their nervous system. Every time it gets close, it shuts down their brain, desynchronizes it, because they haven't got the joy capacity. That might explain a few questions that you have had along the way. So what does it mean to return to joy? It means meeting people in their unhappy feelings, sharing that feeling, letting them know that you're still glad to be with them, acting like yourself while you let them keep the attention on themselves. And these things together return people to joy. And the big 6 feelings to return to joy from are sadness, anger, terror, shame, disgust, and hopeless despair. And that's what a well-trained banana can do. Now, do we return to joy with God? Or are things always joy with God? It says, fill me with joy and gladness. Let the bones which thou hast broken rejoice. Who broke the bones? God, right? Mm-hmm. So was that like glad to be together time for us? Does this scripture suggest quite strongly that God occasionally does things that upset us? And we have to get back to be glad with the very person that upset us, don't we? That's what it means often to return to joy. You have to be glad to be with the exact person that upset you. May those who sow tears reap with shouts of joy. There's a return to joy theme. And when we stay synchronized with God and with others in the middle of our suffering, we suffer well. And so what it means to be mature as a human being, as a Christian, as a nervous system, as a family or an organization, it means that we learn to suffer well by staying synchronized internally and with others during the presence of our suffering. And that's what we're really aiming at. And so you see, the answer then to training people how to return to joy is to join them in their suffering and share their sufferings with them. That's the only way, by experiencing sufferings together with someone else, that you're going to learn how to train this part of your brain. And so you would think that if someone had that plan in mind, that there would be something in his teaching that says we should join each other and share sufferings together. Do you know anybody who taught that? That might be practiced on a worldwide basis. If that were practiced, anyone who's busily involved in that actual practice and experience of doing that in a live relationship with other people that they care about will have these holes in their banana restored. So even if you got a bad banana as a child, you will repair those holes by doing this kind of sharing suffering. Now, the problem with our culture is that we do anything that we can to avoid suffering, and most people come to seek counseling specifically so that they can get out of suffering, not so that they can learn how to suffer well. And the average counselor goes in it with the idea of how do I keep other people from suffering, as opposed to figuring out how can we join them in their suffering. And again, that's one of the reasons why we've gotten exactly no place with addictions. See? Because until you're ready to join them in their suffering, you're not ready to go very far. Now, that we can do a lot easier with alcoholics than we can with sex addicts, because you know what sex addicts do when they're suffering? Something that all of us don't want to have anything to do with. So we're not about to associate with anybody who does that. And if they're going to talk to us about it, they're doing the various things, the very things that we feel that if we're Christians, we're going to have nothing to do with. We can somehow allow it when we're talking about someone who got back into drinking again, because when they're done drinking, as far as we're concerned, it left no social anything, really. You know, you can now not be drinking, you're sober today. But if you had an affair with somebody last night and you come in and you're not having an affair right now, it leaves this imprint, doesn't it? And we haven't figured out how to return to joy under those conditions. We haven't figured out how forgiveness is different from overlooking it. All those kinds of problems that we encounter when we're dealing with sex addiction. So it gets us all in a real intense problem when we begin to look at this area. Now, if we want to then look at what it means to have a mature nervous system and how that compares with trauma, let's look at what it means to be traumatized. We're traumatized when the emotional intensity of an event far exceeds our maturity and our capacity. Does that make sense to you now? We know that your capacity is limited by how much joy you've had. If anything happens to you that's too intense for what your nervous system can handle, it shuts down, it desynchronizes, and we call you being traumatized because your brain is no longer working coherently together. And if it shuts down level 3, it means also I've stopped being relational with you. So whatever happened inside broke off our relationship. You see, that's a desynchronization inside of the brain. And so anything that comes in that's stronger than our strongest joy will shut us down. We call that trauma. As we stop acting like ourselves when we're unable to regulate our emotions anymore. And when we're really badly out of control, we get to the point where we just want to make it stop. And that's where people often will kill somebody else just to make it stop. Or use drugs. Now, Thomas Gerlach, who I actually met here at ICBC, was the first one to help me understand this difference between trauma and suffering. You see, he said to me, you know, don't you, that Jesus wasn't traumatized by the crucifixion. He suffered, but he wasn't traumatized. Now, that inherently struck me it had to be true. Because I would never contemplate giving Jesus therapy for his crucifixion. No. Well, but what was the difference there, you see? And it's obvious, all of us know people who have been through something and one person was traumatized by it and another person wasn't. We go, what's this? You know, what's the difference between the two? And now that we know the difference between them is that one of them may have had less joy capacity than the other, or one of them may have not known how to get back to joy from that event, and so they were stuffed into distress instead. But what is the difference between the trauma and suffering? Trauma is any experience that reduces who we are or understand ourselves to be, and that the unregulated emotional intensity of the traumatic event reduces us to less than we were before. It so upset us that we're never going to go that way again. We say, we can't handle that. That's going to overwhelm me, so I can't do that again. I can't participate in that again. Meanwhile, suffering, those who suffer are at peace with themselves and the world. They might find their capacities drastically reduced, even to the point of death, but they continue to be themselves with the capacities and dominion they have left. So Jesus can say that when I am lifted up, I will draw all men unto myself. With capacities I have left, with the breath that I have left, with what I have left in me, I will continue my mission. And in fact, that's precisely what we see him doing. He is suffering, not traumatized. Any questions? Yes?
I wanted
to ask about OCD, if that happens in level 2, and if that is caused by jewelry, can you ever recover from that? Okay, good question. OCD, is it caused by level 2, and is there the capacity to recover from it ever? OCD is primarily caused at levels 3 and 4. 3 and 4 are the two levels that really develop in response to joy. And so all of the things related to OCD are very much related to the inability to build joy and quiet into your system. And as we will see at the next session after we're talking about acting like yourself, that what develops out of this joy is the very part of your brain that is the alternative to OCD. So after our next hour's presentation, you'll have a lot more information on that subject. Thank you. Yeah, these smart audiences, you know, they always know what's the what goes from here. You know, that's a question that will follow up logically is exactly what we get. That's good. The question is probably the broadest question I've ever been asked at any conference, and the question is, how does the cross affect the brain, and how is it interpreted and received, and what effect does it have with suffering and all of those things? And the first thing that I would have to say is that, you know, in my some 50 years of dealing myself with the cross, I find at every age of my life and everything that I'm going through, it strikes me in a new way and at a different level and affects me in a new way. And so it is something that is so much greater than the nervous system I ever had and what I've ever developed, that as I continue to grow, there's more to that picture than I've ever been able to see up until now. And I don't know if you've had that experience with it yourself, but it is something that fully captures everything you are. And if you're involved with finding what's really going on there, it transforms us in a way that gives us hope we've never had before, in the middle of probably the worst distress we can handle. And what I would say that we have as a common thread is that if we experience Jesus joining with us in the middle of our distress, that is when we encounter transformation. Transformation, as you'll see coming up, doesn't happen to us when we are not in a distressed state. The only time we are transformed is when these things are learned and experienced in the middle of the distress. So the cross is very much like the Good Mother that introduces a distress into our life, that when we confront it, we are given an opportunity to transform and learn how to return to joy. However, I'll tell you, it can have exactly the opposite effect. One of the first traumas in my life was the crucifixion. How much time do I have, Chris?
You have about 10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay, I'll try to make this a 3-minute story, if I can. When I was 4 years old, I was taken to a Good Friday service. And we had 7 preachers that preached on the 7 last words of Jesus. And we were in an area of the world that was very, very violent, and there had been over a quarter of a million people murdered in the area where we were, a lot like the murders in Rwanda that some of you may be familiar with lately, and a lot of people hacked to get to death by machetes and stuff like that, and our churches set on fire. This was a very, very violent environment, and these preachers, all coming out of that violent environment, all had as their goal to portray the crucifixion as worse than anything that ever had happened on their countryside. And so they told in the most graphic details possible how terrible the sufferings and the crucifixion of Jesus had been. And every preacher of the 7 competed with the previous one to outdo himself in the intensity and of the gore that they portrayed. I mean, Mel Gibson had nothing on these guys. I was 4 years old, and they all ended with pointing their finger into the crowd and saying, "And you're the one who killed him." Now, at 4 years of age, you understand I've not yet reached the point where I can distinguish between fantasy, reality, and feelings. So when they said, "You're the one that killed him," I assumed I had actually had done that. Now, this is not uncommon for a child, you see, because my parents could show me pictures of visiting my grandma and grandpa and uncles and stuff like that I'd done when I was 3. Or 2, and I didn't remember being there, but there was the pictures, and sure enough, I'd done it. So I took it to be the case that I had done these things. Only by that age, I already knew that I loved Jesus probably more than my parents, and this was the person that loved me most, and it greatly agonized me that I could have done something like that. And so I was left with this terrible feeling that haunted me for years. By the time I was 6 or 7, I'd figured out the story, but inside me, the feelings were still there, that something about me was a murderer. And in fact, that I would kill anybody that got close to me that I might love. you could understand how that might mess up your thoughts about relationships considerably. So, again, I would say, when we look at the crucifixion, even there we must take into account the limits of the weaker mind and bring it to each person in terms of what they can handle at their time and what they need. Now, wonderful story, which we could get to, and in fact might in the next section, was how that all was resolved for me. And if you remind me when I'm going through the steps for resolving some of these traumas, I'll tell you how that story ended up. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, back there. Okay. The question is, I was talking about returning to joy within 90 seconds. Why is it 90 seconds? Because that is, in fact, how fast your nervous system will quiet itself if it's running right. One of the wonderful things that I do, for instance, with adolescents when they come in, adolescents, I don't know if you remember that period of time, but adolescents have a terrible time with their own emotions. And among other reasons, it's because one of the chemicals in the body that renders serotonin relatively ineffective, well, there's a couple of chemicals. One is called estrogen and the other is called testosterone. Have you heard of those? Somewhere around age 13, your body has a major increase in the level of testosterone and estrogen. And then the amount of serotonin your body has on board is no longer nearly as effective as it was before. So you can't quiet yourself as well as you were. You're much more irritable and much more reactive. Have you noticed that sort of starting around that age, you know? Okay, it's in the wiring. And there's reasons for it, but nonetheless, there they are. Well, teenagers are notoriously bad at quieting themselves. But what I teach them to do is what we're going to be learning to do in pain lab tomorrow. And that is how to learn to trigger that response inside of your own nervous system that will take you from a distressed state. And if you try to maintain it as long as you can, and as strongly as you can, it will disappear within 90 seconds if you know how to do it. You simply can't maintain it any longer. In fact, it's rare to run over 60 seconds. What keeps it there a long time is running away from it. The fear of the emotion, the not knowing how to handle it. That can keep it going for years. But if you face and actually encounter an emotion, you know how to deal with it, it doesn't last very long. It's just the same way, this little graphic, but guys will understand this. It's a response, emotional response, a great deal like the male orgasm. You know, if I was to tell any of the guys here, keep it going for longer than 90 seconds, they'd look at me like, well, yeah, according to what? You know, it just, after a while, it's done. And your nervous system goes, that's it. That's all I'm going to do. I'm quitting now. And later, it can respond again. It's the same thing with your emotions. It's a self-limiting response. Those who can know how to do it can respond, and they know that their system quieted down within that period of time. And those that don't know how are still on the run, getting away from it. So perhaps a little graphic, and if I made you uncomfortable, I understand why. I just didn't know another better way to illustrate the point. And I would trust perhaps that by now as we're entering a part of people's lives that centers around how they use their orgasm and their sexuality to regulate all our emotions, that we can begin to talk about it a little bit in a public context. I know this isn't what we usually do, and so consequently we're very uncomfortable about it, but still, as guardedly as we can, we need to kind of look at this subject if we're going to be able to help people who are dealing with sexual addictions. So I understand, and at the same time apologize for any discomfort this might be causing. Yes?
I said two comments. First, I read that orgasm is also used in the command, be angry but do not sin. Be angry to be orgasm.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense to me in view of your quote from Mark 3.
Uh-huh. The orge that's actually a derivative. I think it's orgizomai. Okay. It's a derivative from the word, and there's some debate as to how derived and how distant it was, so I just stop short of using that. But it's very likely that it's very close, and that your point is well taken, and I'll repeat it for the tape, that the word for angry, be angry and sin not, is very closely related to the word for the anger that Jesus had. And so, again, the concept in Scripture is that you can act like yourself without sinning in the middle of this kind of emotional intensity, which is exactly what we're aiming at. So, yes. Second comment.
The other thing I wanted to mention was I think your teaching has helped clarify something, because when I work with, for instance, sex abuse survivors, they describe in considerable detail the traumas they've experienced, enormous emotion distress week after week after week, and they keep telling me that this is helping. It does not appear to be helping to me at all. It just appears to be revivifying a lot of distress until I've done this enough, long enough, I can see after months or years in some cases, I start to experience this quiet together thing or this joy thing in the context of even when they're talking about their distress.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish it was 90 seconds, but I haven't seen it 90 seconds very often.
Right. Okay, then I'll repeat that comment for the tape. That first is that dealing with survivors of sexual abuse, he hasn't seen a lot of 90-second relief going on. That as a result of what he felt was a almost tedious process of hearing these stories over and over and over again, in which nothing really seemed to be changing, people were reporting to him that this was helping in some way or another. And one of the two comments that I can add to that in terms of interpretation is, first of all, one of the things that is going on, if it is helping, but no one is particularly paying attention to, is that they're having somebody track their emotions up and down, and they're actually entering into some of these mutual states of right hemisphere to right hemisphere communication. And they are learning how to stay relational in the middle of a distress that was never relational before. It's answering the question, what do me and my people do when we encounter this distress? And up till now, the answer has been they ignore me. And this new answer, which is they pay attention to me and my distress and they care about it, that is a whole new answer. Their brain has never seen that one before in this kind of distress, and it answers a whole different answer to what is it like us to do. It's like us to stay relational. The second part of the answer is that after I'm through telling the story, I'm not abandoned. And the thing that happens with sexual abuse that inevitably comes out is that all of that sexual abuse and distress ends with abandonment instead of quiet together. And in this, we have a quiet together. When we're all done with all of this, what we do is we're still in relationship, we've quieted it together, and now we learn that distress leads to quiet together instead of to abandonment, and that's a whole new experience for the brain as well. One other comment about why it often takes a very long time, and that is that usually people are bringing this back to their mind at the point where they just barely have the joy capacity to handle it. And so the story has to come in a little bit at a time. They've got just enough joy to handle this amount of it. And they can only take it a little bit at a time, and they process it as much as joy as they have. As that builds, their joy gets bigger and bigger. And so they're able to handle bigger and bigger parts of it. But you're usually taxing every bit of the joy capacity that people have at that particular time to tell you as much of the story as they could. They realize, that's all I could handle today. That's their dealing at their joy limits. And that's why if they came in with unlimited joy limits, then you could take it all at once and we'd be done. Then you probably could be done in 90 seconds. But people don't come in with unlimited joy. So we want to talk about how do we build joy and all of that. So come back whenever the break is over, and we will start talking about acting like yourself.